Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're not back yet in the labor market, not by a long ways, but the unemployment report this morning was a very good start. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. And by Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, today the 2nd of April. Good to have you with us. 162,000 is the magic number. That's how many jobs the economy added from the beginning of March to the end, the biggest monthly gain in 3 years. It's even good that the unemployment rate stayed where it was, 9.7%. That means more people probably got into the labor market in hopes of finding a job. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more on today's report and whether we can keep it up.
Right off the bat, I have to tell you that about half the jobs the private sector created last month were temporary. But hey, a job's a job, right? Nigel Galt is chief U.S. economist for IHS Global Insight.
I'd probably be in the glass half full rather than half empty camp. The positive news out of this report is that it does signal clearly that we have turned the corner to job creation.
There were job gains in almost every major U.S. industry, 27,000 in healthcare, 15,000 in retail, and 17,000 in manufacturing, making things like machinery and steel beams. Those job gains were due to a jump in U.S. exports. Manufacturers not tied to exports didn't hire many people. Dave Huther is chief economist at the National Association of Manufacturers.
I don't think we're going to see really significant increases in employment in manufacturing. Probably until 2011, 2012, when the domestic economy starts picking up steam and grows along with the global growth overseas.
Okay, so manufacturing won't be the engine for job growth, at least for now. Nigel Galt says an army of those temp workers will lead the charge, but that situation will be temporary.
But it's been driving employment over the past 4 or 5 months, and as companies look to remain very flexible in their plans, they're still going to be relying on a lot of temporaries over the next few months.
After that, Galt expects the service sector to take over. He's even hoping to see gains in higher-paying marketing and R&D jobs. Most economists say whatever sector takes the lead, the economy is expected to continue creating jobs, slowly. Lou Crandall is chief economist at Rights and ICAP.
It's going to take years, but all you can really ask for at this point is the right direction. And month by month, we see more and more evidence of that.
Economists will also be looking for evidence that the jobs being created are good jobs, permanent, full-time, well-paying, with benefits, like the manufacturing jobs created last month. They pay an average of more than $72,000 a year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There is a certain beauty to a rising economy. When people have jobs or the prospect of them, they tend to buy things. And when they buy things, they pay taxes. And when they pay taxes, governments have more money. There was news today from the Census Bureau on that front. State and local tax revenues went up in the fourth quarter of last year, the first time in more than a year that that's happened. It's one more sign that the worst has probably passed, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
At first glance, the numbers look pretty good. State and local governments took in nearly 1% more in the fourth quarter of last year than they did in the same period of the year before. Kim Rubin is a fellow at the Urban Institute. She says you have to remember that 2008 was a really bad year, so it didn't take much to do better.
It's the first period that the comparison year was also in free fall.
Rubin says it's going to take municipalities a long time to recover completely.
But part of it is once you hit bottom, you start getting better, but you're still not back at where you were before the bottom fell out.
Sales and income taxes fell again. It's property taxes that pulled the number up. They rose 5.8%. That's good news for local governments because that's where they get most of their money. The problem is, in a lot of places, those taxes are still being calculated based on real estate prices from the peak of the boom. Don Boyd is a fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. He says different states assess property values at different times. Some do it every 3 years. Others just do it when the property is sold.
So it may be time before some of those assessed valuations are lowered by assessors to reflect changes in market values.
And he says those revaluations could pummel tax revenues. Some states are already in trouble because they thought tax revenues would rebound faster than they have. And things could get worse as stimulus money starts running out later this year. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
All right, so here comes the rain on your parade portion of today's broadcast. A deal between iron ore producers and steelmakers over in Japan has some analysts a little worried. Here to explain is our European correspondent, Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So what exactly has happened with iron ore contracts?
Well, this week, the mining industry abandoned a 40-year-old custom and switched from negotiating annual contracts to supply iron ore to their customers to signing quarterly deals. This means the price of iron ore is going to be a lot more volatile. It's going to be related to the current market, the spot price of the metal. And that means the price that steelmakers will pay will vary sometimes quite quickly from one quarter to the next.
By how much do you think?
Well, it can be quite a lot. I mean, what we saw this week was the price absolutely shot up because demand for iron ore is quite high at the moment. The market's tight, largely because of Chinese demand. The spot market price of iron ore is roughly double what the old annual price was. So that meant steelmakers were suddenly paying double, about $120 a ton.
Double can't possibly be good. I'm just thinking of, say, cars, things that use a lot of steel, right?
Absolutely. I mean, iron ore is the major component of steel. And steel, as we know, is a major commodity in a whole range of things. Construction, you mentioned automobiles, white goods, domestic appliances. This does suggest that we're going to see some quite hefty price rises as a result of this. Not perhaps so high in the U.S., because interestingly, the U.S. tends to recycle more of its steel than other steelmaking countries, so it's less exposed to the increase in the iron ore price.
Hmm. But worldwide, then, could prices ever come down? I mean, you know, a fool's errand, perhaps.
Oh, certainly they could. And in some analysts are saying that we could see the price of iron ore fall back quite sharply over the next few quarters if, as seems likely, the Chinese tighten credit to stop their economy from overheating. That could knock the price of iron ore quite sharply lower, and that would happen much more quickly than if this was an annual contract.
One more thing about these pricing contracts, Stephen, now going from quarterly to annual. It does open up iron ore contracts to this ability to trade the contracts themselves, right?
That's very much so. And at the moment, there is a derivatives market in, you know, swaps and options, puts and calls and so on in iron ore, but it's relatively small, about $300 million. Not a great deal of volatility in the price and therefore not much of a percentage for the dealers. Now, with these quarterly contracts, the system's likely to lead to much bigger swings in the price of iron ore. And so we've now got apparently banks and brokerages licking their lips over a potentially huge new derivatives market. Some say we could be talking about a market growing as big as $200 billion.
Just what we need, more derivatives. Stephen Beard at the Marketplace European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
Back home on Wall Street today, slim pickings, really. Stock exchanges were closed. Still, though, there is stuff to talk about. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Easter is almost upon us, or to think about it a slightly different way, the fourth biggest holiday for retailers is almost upon us. According to the National Retail Federation, Easter ranks just behind Christmas, Valentine's Day, and Mother's Day in consumer spending. So far, Easter looks like it's going to bring in slightly more money than it did last year. That reverses a trend we saw during the recession. Shoppers, it seems, are finally ready to snatch up food, candies, decorations, and anything else they might find at the mall while they're in the buying mood. That also includes eggs, an item that is finally seeing the sunny side of sales again. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The National Retail Federation says Americans are on track to spend about $13 billion this Easter. Spokeswoman Kathy Grannis says that's about 2% more than last year.
Every holiday so far for 2010 has seen some kind of slight increase. That is a big change from what we've seen the last 2 years, where consumers were being a little bit more cautious with their spending.
And it means more money for greeting cards, decorations, candy, and most of all, food. The egg industry stands to benefit, and not just because of all the eggs people will be decorating. Kevin Burkham is with the American Egg Board. He says after decades of anti-yolk sentiment from cholesterol-conscious consumers, egg sales are finally starting to harden.
With more people cooking at home and eating at home and entertaining at home as opposed to going out, eggs have certainly benefited from that.
Burkham says right now Americans average 250 eggs a year. That's nowhere near the 400 we consumed in the 50s, but it's up from the 235 we ate in the 90s.
You know, for those of us in the egg industry, there's perhaps too many plastic and candied eggs around, but again, it's all a celebration of the egg.
We found Nydia Menash in New York's Union Square. She says she's buying 40 eggs this Easter versus just a dozen last year.
Last year, there were more money. This year, I went to Target, and there were better prices. So I'm going to stock up, take advantage.
Well, she sounds like a grade-A miracle for the egg industry, but wait.
Oh, you mean the regular eggs? Oh, no, we don't do those.
Oh, that's probably not going to go over easy. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It's a little sleepy out there today, business and economy-wise, what with stock markets being closed for Good Friday and all. Still, there is plenty to talk about with our weekly wrappers. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine is with us. Also, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
It's great to be here, Kai.
All right, so here we go. Obviously, it's jobs, jobs, jobs. We talked about it a little bit up at the top. Lee, where's your gut on this one?
My gut is that it was a pretty good number. I mean, especially if you look at the private payrolls jumping to their highest level in 3 years or so. I think that this is a sort of a seminal moment here. If you look beneath the numbers, you see things like manufacturing added, construction gained for the first time since 2007. There were also revisions upward for the previous 2 months before this month. So I think it was a pretty good day, and I think we're going to see that on Monday.
Well, yeah, we'll get to the Monday part of this in a second. Felix, give me your quick read on these numbers.
I think there's a limit to how much you can extrapolate from a single month's data. There's no doubt that it was positive, but the unemployment figures are still very high. They don't seem to be coming down at all. And in fact, the underemployment number went up. And I'm hopeful that we're going to continue to see over the next few months a series of more positive figures, and then I'll be happy. But right now, after just one of these, I'm not quite optimistic
yet.
You're
kind of middling, yeah. All right, so do me a favor and elaborate on the underemployment thing you mentioned, because I think that's a really important slice of this pie.
It's huge. It's all of the people who aren't working nearly as much as they want to work. It's people who have part-time positions but who want full-time positions. It's people who are earning money but they don't consider themselves to be fully employed. And that number went up, and it's a drag on the economy. And until that number starts coming down, I can't see the economy really sort of firing on even like two or three cylinders, really.
Let alone all, however many it is, right? One hopes it's like a 12-cylinder car. So, Lee, on this Monday thing, I closed the show yesterday pointing out that the markets are closed today, and thus traders will not have an opportunity to either celebrate or bemoan the numbers. Turns out they're reasonably celebratory. So, Lee, what's Monday going to be like?
I think it's going to be up. I mean, there's no telling. This market has been propelled on kind of air. I mean, and so with little tangible data. So when you have some tangible data that's actually at the heart of what everybody's been waiting for, the market could really go bananas. I mean, we've just come off the best first quarter performance since 1999. So now that we just have this number that's pretty positive, I mean, there's no telling what's going to happen.
Let me change gears here just briefly. I want to talk for a second about something that was all over the news last fall, executive compensation. We learned this week that hedge fund managers are making billions. Wall Street CEOs are seeing their pay go down by like a tenth of 1% in the past year. Question, Lee, is where's the outrage? I mean, have we all forgotten about Wall Street and hedge funds and all that stuff that happened?
It's certainly quieted down. Wherever that outrage is, it's probably in the same place where the outrage over the lack of financial regulatory reform is. They're probably hiding in the same place. But it's a great point. The one thing I will say is that if you look into the numbers, they do tend to correspond with how those companies' stock performances did. So at least it's not like we're giving all that money to people whose companies kind of cratered. But it's definitely, we're not hearing that. And one reason might be this stock performance. I mean, this quarterly performance that's the best in a decade might be some powerful hush money. I mean, everybody has 401ks and maybe even populist America is not caring as much. I don't know.
Felix, you care?
I care. And I think Lee is right that it's largely down to stock performance. And I think that's a bad thing because it's pretty obvious that the best performing stocks over the past few months or even the past year have actually been in many ways the worst companies because they got beaten down so much that they just bounced back way more than the healthy companies did. And so now we're seeing CEOs paying themselves millions and millions of dollars on the basis of they run crappy companies which were sold off in the worst part of the crisis. And that doesn't make sense to me.
So we're back to my favorite theme, crisis wasted, right? Here we are 2 years later, and it's all the same.
It's actually worse than it was before. <in the US.
laughs> Oh, man. Happy Friday, you guys. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Felix Salmon, he blogs for Reuters. Thank you.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up, what's the first thing you're going to do during your Easter weekend holiday? It's buy an iPad, right?
And I found out we were going to be traveling. It's the first thing I did was find the store that would be closest to where we were going to be and reserve one there.
Yeah, I knew that was it. But first, let's do the numbers. American stock markets were closed today in observance of Good Friday, but it was a winning streak for the week that ended yesterday. The Dow Industrials gained 0.7%. The S&P 500 added 1%. The NASDAQ edged up 0.3% for the four-day week. Bond traders did business today till noon. That report on the biggest increase in jobs in 3 years sparked the bond sell-off as investors rushed to buy riskier assets. Long-term bond rates were the most affected. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.93%, the highest level since last June. Oil, metals, and key agricultural commodities climbed about 1% today as investors piled in. Oil hit an 18-month peak, topped $85 a barrel. Copper and platinum hit 20-month highs. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. Fitness activities are on the agenda at the annual White House Easter Egg Roll, all part of the national campaign to combat childhood obesity. And President Obama participates in another tradition, baseball. He'll throw the first pitch before the season opener between the Washington Nationals and the Philadelphia Phillies. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. With jobs starting to show up in the economy at long last, people who have been laid off can once again start to have hope, hope of eventually finding work, if not right away. But for some portion of the people out there, it's going to be too late to save themselves financially, to save their homes, or to save their credit scores. Some new figures on bankruptcy filings came out today. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been covering the story for us. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Kai.
So these bankruptcy numbers, what do they tell us?
Well, personal and business bankruptcy filings have now hit a peak. It's the highest since October 2005. You may remember that's when bankruptcy reform kicked in. Mm-hmm. It made it harder to get out from all your debts, and it kept people out of bankruptcy court for a while. But with the economy so bad for so long now, they're showing up again. So there were 158,000 bankruptcies filed in March. That works out to nearly 7,000 a day. They're up about 20% from the same time last year.
Just to be clear here, Mitchell, bankruptcies are on the rise as the economy is slowly getting better.
Right. And in fact, they were up by more than a third just between February and March. But there's actually two reasons why that is not quite so surprising. First off, believe it or not, spring is apparently bankruptcy season. It's because people get refund checks. It could cost you $2,000 or $3,000 to pay for a bankruptcy lawyer. Ooh. So you have the money, you look at your bills, and you decide now's the time to file. The other thing is, you know, keep in mind, it's probably going to take 6 to 18 months for people to finally hit the wall financially after a recession hits. So this is actually just about when you'd expect to see a bulge in bankruptcies. Yeah.
This sounds almost elementary, but it's obviously tied into the job loss figures and the housing market, right?
Those two are really probably the bulk of the reason. Job loss, I guess in some senses, is pretty obvious. You run out of savings, you've tapped your friends and family. You know, bankruptcy might look like the only out at this point. The housing issue is a little more complicated. It comes down to, do I want to keep paying my mortgage if I'm underwater, you know, if I owe way more on the house than it's worth? These people apparently are increasingly filing Chapter 7 bankruptcy. This is the kind of bankruptcy that's a little easier, it's cheaper, and you basically just walk away from your debts. Most likely that includes your mortgage. So it's for people who basically don't have enough income anymore. They're just declaring bankruptcy to get out from under it all.
If we took a map of these bankruptcy filings and a map of where the housing crisis hit worst and put them on top of each other, would they match up?
Yeah, they'd match up pretty well. Yeah. But don't trust me on this, because this is a big spreadsheet that I pulled up on my computer. So I asked Mike Bickford of AACER. That stands for Automated Access to Court Electronic Records. This is the company that compiles this monthly data. And I asked him to help me out.
California had a 15% increase over their 2009 monthly average. That's significant. Arizona is 10% higher. And another thing, Mitchell, you'll look at is what the ranking is on the per capita filing. That's per 1,000 heads.
I see that. And then you got Nevada's number one.
Nevada's number one. Tennessee's number two. And Georgia's number three.
And the interesting thing here is the South used to top this list, hands down. Now it's Nevada at the top of the list. So, yeah, you know, lay that map of bankruptcies over the map of the housing crisis, and they match up pretty closely.
Let me ask you this, Mitchell, before I let you go. As time goes by in this recovery, can we expect bankruptcies to mount for a little while and then taper off?
I think what we're going to see is probably the upside down U. You know, it's probably going to go up before it goes down, and the economy needs to start getting better before people can keep their homes and keep their businesses.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman on some new bankruptcy numbers out today. Thanks, Mitchell.
You're welcome.
All right, let's see. What's going on this weekend? Well, there's college basketball. There's a new 3D movie out, Clash of the Titans, although I hear the 3D is not really very good. Sunday, as we mentioned, is Easter. Oh, and then there's that iPad thing tomorrow. Of course, you know what that means. Thousands of the faithful lined up at Apple stores waiting for the doors to open. If past really is prologue, they're probably lining up right now in shopping malls all over the country. Sally Herships reports that those malls have plans of their own for the big day.
Ian Meyer is 25. He lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and here's what he has planned for his vacation in Washington, D.C. this weekend: waking up at 6 a.m. and heading to the nearest mall to pick up his new Apple iPad.
And I found out we were going to be traveling. It's the first thing I did was find the store that would be closest to where we were going to be and reserve one there.
Meyer is a huge Apple fan. Not only did he work in one of the stores for a while, but when New York City's Fifth Avenue location opened in 2006, Meyer camped out for 33 hours in the rain, just so that he could be one of the first people through the door. Malls know the Meyers of the world will be descending on them this weekend, and they are prepared.
It involves security. It involves housekeeping. It involves giving an update to all the stores that may be affected with this, especially the restaurants.
Mike McAvenue is the general manager at New Jersey's upscale mall at Short Hills. He says this weekend, the mall is expecting 2,000 customers to show up for iPads. The mall can handle a line of about 300 people inside, but there still will be lots of overflow onto the sidewalk.
For customer convenience, we actually put in some very high-end porta-potties.
With mirrors and fresh flowers. The porta-potties will run the mall a few hundred dollars a day. When you add in the other costs, like extra security, the tab climbs to about $2,000. McAvenue says it's worth it, especially if it gets shoppers out of the Apple store and into the mall faster.
And that customer, you know, will come here and they will visit restaurants that day. They may visit another shop that particular day. It's a win-win.
There are more than 200 Apple stores in the U.S., and the vast majority are in malls. Most of them, including Short Hills, are planning to open early to accommodate the iPad crowds. But one mall that doesn't need to make any special preparations is the Mall of America in Minnesota. It's the country's biggest mall with 4.2 million square feet. Big events are routine there.
The Jonas Brothers have come out, and they drew a huge crowd, especially all the teeny boppers.
Erica Dow is spokesperson for the mall. I told her the mall at Short Hills would be giving free coffee to waiting customers and about the fancy porta potties.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. They're trumping us in what we're doing for the iPad launch then.
Dow says Mall of America has over 40 million visitors a year. They're all set with security and bathrooms, but their Apple store will be opening an hour early on Saturday. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Ben Bernanke said a couple of months ago the recession was technically over, which is nice and all, but interestingly enough, the Fed chairman is not the guy who gets to decide. A group of people who make up something called the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research are the ones who officially get to say when recessions begin and end. The chairman of that committee is a Stanford University economist named Robert Hall, very nice guy, and he said today's job report makes it pretty clear, quote, that the recession is truly over. For what it's worth, the official date of the beginning of the recession, December of 07, was the last time there was any significant job growth in this economy. Of course, till today, that is. And on this Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Nothing to report on the numbers today. The stock market was closed for Good Friday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on this weekend's personal finance program, Marketplace Money, the cost of all your modern connections. Boy, it adds up fast.
I think if somebody was like, you can have all of this stuff for $700 a month.
There's no way we would ever sign up for that.
Yeah, no. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back with this program on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.